The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
There's been a lot of noisy talk, particularly since COVID, from anti-vaxxers, and now with one of the most notorious anti-vaxxers running health in the US and measles taking off again in that country, we thought we'd look at a long tradition of ill-informed anti-vax protests. We're joined by David Robert Grimes, author of The Irrational Ape, How Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk. David, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
250 years.
It's a strange anniversary. So one of the most common things when I'm talking to media outlets about, say, whatever most recent nonsense is in the news, is I often have to point out that this is really old. A claim that might seem like it's very modern or be dressed up in the garb of modern claims is actually sometimes up to 250 years old. Now, to give you an idea, the anti-vaccine movement is technically older than vaccines themselves. Now, how does that make any sense?
No, it doesn't.
Because we had inoculations before, which weren't as safe as vaccinations. But the anti-vaccine movement stirred around then. They were unhappy with people being inoculated against cowpox, well, with cowpox against smallpox. They thought it was against, it offended God. It offended who was allowed to die or who was not allowed to die. And that was the original objection.
And we remember how that came about with the milkmaids who didn't get smallpox.
Absolutely. And it was an observation. They had been exposed to cowpox and therefore had a sense of, they had some immunity. And that was the basic genesis of that. But one of the first pamphlets, which I collect anti-vaccine memorabilia, which is a weird hobby, is one from 1722 by the Reverend Edmund Massey, and it's called On the Sinful and Dangerous Practices of Inoculation. And it essentially argues that this is against the will of God because you're choosing who will live and who will die. Now, most of the anti-vaccine arguments actually centered around personal health freedom. And this is something that's very modern, seems modern. It's what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is claiming, that it's a personal choice to vaccinate and all that kind of stuff. But these arguments are really, really old. In the 1800s, you had the anti-vaccine leagues set up in the UK. Now, these were usually in response to the fact that lots of people were dying of smallpox. We had an effective vaccine, and there was an idea to roll it out in schools and educational places where people, children, were most terribly affected by it. They opposed this on the grounds that actually it should be our right to, you know, choose whether children get vaccines or not.
Now, the whole idea of herd immunity, which we now understand, is so important.
Very important, yeah. Because remember, you're protecting people that can't get vaccinated. So weird enough, this was fought in courts for a long time. It seems very modern, but it's very old in one way. In the 1850s, this was fought in UK courts and French courts, and they ruled that an individual's right does not outstrip the another person's right not to die of smallpox. So someone's conscience cannot then say, so if you want to be in a public facility, and this was the argument that was made, if you want to send your kids to school, you know, in one of these UK institutions or French institutions of the 1850s, they needed to be vaccinated because they didn't have the right to kill people that were vulnerable in that classroom. So it was always a balancing of rights.
I'm not sure about the manner of infection of smallpox, but I presume the pox itself is infectious.
Partly, but it was, it'll burst and it has a mild airborne radius around it. So being in close proximity with someone with smallpox was a real thing. And that was the major thing. It's one of the first effective vaccines we had. Also, by the way, this was fought in 1905 in the Supreme Court in the US. This went all the way to the Supreme Court about whether it was constitutional to have vaccine mandates for educational facilities and public places. And it turns out, yes, because again, an individual's right to have a point of view on something doesn't outstrip someone else's right not to get sick.
Now, you talk about how the very success of vaccines has worked against them in a sense, because people don't see many people dying of measles. They don't see polio. They don't see a lot of things that would have been common and now have effectively vanished.
Yeah, so vaccines are victims of their own success in a huge way. We no longer see bodies twisted by polio or, you know, people scarred with smallpox or even children deafened by measles. It's not that common. And then people get a bit complacent because, firstly, I mean, a very common argument when I talk to vaccine hesitant parents that I hear is, well, you know, no one we know has had measles, so we're not getting vaccinated against measles because it's not common. And you have to explain the reason it's not common is it's being kept at bay with vaccination. If that starts to go down like it is in the States or in the UK at the moment, suddenly you get outbreaks again. So again, people get complacent is one thing, and it's much easier to rewrite the history. We have a lot of revisionism, particularly from anti-vaccine figures like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. They will revise the history to pretend that vaccines had no effect on it. I need to remind people that in the the 19th century, almost half of all children died before the age of five. And they died mainly for not being vaccinated and having poor sanitation. It is only improvements in those two things that have made us, you know, now it's a rare tragedy if a child dies young. but it used to be so commonplace. And if you look through Irish birth records, if you go back through genealogical census stuff, you see the amount of children that died before they reached the age of five. And that was mainly infectious disease and sanitation.
And earlier on the programme, we were talking to Luke O'Neill about the consternation among the scientific community now in the States because of the mRNA funding pause that RFK has imposed on that development.
And as Luke pointed out, for absolutely no reason, again, mRNA doesn't just deal with vaccination. It's also what we use for cancer treatments these days. So this is setting us back many, many generations. And it's really grim to see these old myths gain new currency because, again, 250 plus years old, most of these claims.
And from RFK, a man who vaccinated his own children.
Yeah, of course, of course. I mean, but also was he, I mean, he is the most perversely ill-suited person to hold the office he's holding. But then again, you could say that Trump was the president of the states as well.
Now, your second topic today is science fraud. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So this is a grim topic and something I have a little bit of a horse in the race of that I should clarify that. I get myself in trouble there. But so, unfortunately, there's a growing pressure on scientists to publish, to get their advance their careers. And that has led to certain unethical scientists being quite happy to commit fraud, maybe massage a result, maybe make something look more sexy than it really is. And this is the reason that journals prefer novel, impressive results than something that, like, you know, that drug didn't work.
So it's publish or perish. So in order to get published, you do something that appears dramatic.
Exactly. And unfortunately, that is, it's always been a problem in science. We've known it for a very long time. Historically, even in anti-vaccine fraud, we could talk about Andrew Wakefield's paper in 1998. So it's always happened. But there's an increasing awareness that this is becoming commonplace and is really impeding how much we can trust science. And this is a problem that scientists have to address. So this week, there was a study released in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the US, where they looked at these networks of fraudulent groups that were basically creating these awful papers and then trying to amp up their own metrics by spreading them out there. And they found by analysing the network of these corrupt editors and these corrupt scientists that they were creating a huge problem. They found over 30,000 suspect publications. And that's probably the tip of the iceberg.
Now, when there's plagiarism and people, you know, stealing each other's results and so on, and we know Navarro wrote this book or quoted a book under a nanogram of his own name, to back up the tariff theory. I mean, that's how blatant it can be.
But AI is making it much easier to be blatant about it too, because I can tell AI to write me a paper. And people are doing this. I mean, I reviewed a paper recently where I found very obvious hallmarks of AI generation. They had left in an AI prompt saying, I'm a large language model, I can't answer this question. It's the only reason I could tell that it was very definitely AI.
Now, the people had used phrases to get around plagiarism detection,
yes.
But AI may, in fact, improve detection.
So this is a thing called tortured phrases. This is one of the ways we use to find fraudulent papers. Now, full disclaimer, I do a lot of work with Retraction Watch, which is a charity that focuses on finding dodgy papers, and I'm a sleuth in residence for them. So I look at this a lot. But tortured phrases were the classic tell. You'd things like, for example, bosom peril instead of breast cancer, because they'd flop it around. The other one was anal canal got changed to butt-centric waterway, which which is a real tell that someone has done something funny. But AI is now a little bit cleverer. That used to be just a dictionary lookup where they would swap words around and then plagiarise someone else's work.
So now a AI bogus upside is a false positive.
False positive is a bogus upside. There's a whole dictionary of these, and some of them are quite brilliant because they're, there was some that would just make you roar out. And you saw them in a paper, if you were reviewing it, you'd know immediately these. And it started a lot of it in India and China, where there was huge pressures on researchers there to maintain, like in China, to keep a medical position. You're supposed to publish 3 scientific papers a year. Yeah. So there's a huge pressure on people who are just doctors to suddenly spam out these pay-per-play papers that are garbage, and they know they're garbage, but they need them.
Now, what about the anti-scientific bias in the White House at the moment? And if you are a scientist and you want to keep working, do people then start writing papers that suit the dear leader?
And that is going to happen. And this is the problem. And this is the thing we call perverse incentivization, right? What we need to do, and I've always said this and sounding slightly communist, we need to give scientists stable jobs where they are just paid to do good research. But if you have a career that's dependent on saying the right things and is not the correct things, the politically correct things, which are different, if your career becomes dependent on that, you're going to set up an incentivization for people to do dodgy things. A lot of the people that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has promoted to his new FDAs are people that were cranks already, that were people that had these fringe views, and they have been rewarded for that. So there is a thing that scientists do need to clean up our own house, but we also need to change our incentivization structure. Most scientists are in very insecure employment. The vast majority of young academics are on temporary contracts, and it creates an incentive for people to maybe nudge, maybe just elbow their results a little bit to make them look a bit better. And unfortunately, that means we can't trust large volumes of things. So there's a sea change that has to happen to address that.
Fake news.
David
Robert Grimes, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.